Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a bit about the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. I've mentioned in previous podcasts, one a few months ago, about Harry Truman's confrontations with America's trade unions in the immediate aftermath of the war. Truman was deeply inflexible when it came to organised labour. He wasn't entirely unsympathetic towards them, but in the condition, the climate of the Cold War, he saw any sort of internal dissent based on pay bargaining as a almost treasonous act of disunity. And the fact that the political mood since about 1944 had begun to radically shift towards the centre-right, away from the centre-ish left of the New Deal years, meant that the unions were not operating in favourable political circumstances. As we've already seen, Truman managed to face down the rail unions in 1946, but it was coal that would provide one of the biggest challenges to his presidency. 95% of American locomotives still ran on coal, and it was the source of 62% of all America's electricity, as the coal-fired power station was still the dominant means of generating wattage. And the coal unions looked at the advent of oil in the automobile market and in every other regard, and saw it as a rival power source to coal, more efficient and in greater supply potentially, and were highly anxious about the ability of the United States now to control much of the world's oil supply, either in America or increasingly in the Middle East. The titanic figure at the head of the United Mine Workers of America Union, John L. Lewis, believed that he was able to extract almost any concession from the government, given the power that coal had in the US economy. He essentially believed that no government could be trusted to support workers' rights, particularly the miners' rights, and therefore no government was really worth his absolute loyalty. In 1928, he'd supported Herbert Hoover. In 1936, he switched his support to Franklin Roosevelt. He tacitly helped Roosevelt in 1932. And in 1936, He swung a huge amount of union support and money behind Roosevelt for re-election. However, he was suspicious of both conservatives and liberals, and certainly had no love for Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman. He split with Roosevelt on the issue of the war and was a firm isolationist. Even though he had been a supporter of most of the New Deal legislation in the mid-1930s. He was a heroic figure amongst the mining communities of the northeastern states, places like Pennsylvania, and he was revered across the industry as somebody that was willing to fight head-on for the miners. He's quite a fierce, stern figure who was intimidating to politicians and other unionists alike. And of course he was hated by Harry Truman, who referred to him as a racketeer. And here's Harry Truman's attack on the rail unions in Congress on May 25th, 1946 was also a barbed attack on Lewis as well. Previously, as we've seen, if you remember the previous podcast I did on Truman and the unions, the unions essentially blink in May 1946 when Truman publicly criticises them and introduces harsh anti-union laws in Congress. And the unions come to terms. They're, as I said, they blink first. But in November of 1946, Lewis decided that he did not like the terms to which had been agreed and wished to revise them. And so he called out 400,000 miners with the threat of strike if his demands were not adhered to. Truman was this time determined to put up as much a fight as possible and saw this battle as one of the kind of the key tests of his presidency. Obviously, winter was on the way, and most importantly, Truman saw Lewis as the kind of his nemesis, somebody that was deliberately trying to challenge his authority. Truman gained a court order which stopped the proposed strike, but Lewis ignored it, and the result was a federal judge handing down a fine to the union of $3.5 million, and Lewis personally got a fine of $10,000, an astronomical sums of money for the time. And the judge referred to the strike as an evil, demonic, monstrous thing that means hunger and cold and unemployment and disorganisation of the social fabric. If actions of this kind can be successfully persisted in, the government will be overthrown. Now, this is, hyperbolic to say the least. A government that has survived the Second World War is unlikely to be done down by striking coal miners. But the reason why we have this hyperbole is no doubt to do with the anxieties of the Cold War itself. Because the president saw that he had essentially won this round and there was little that Lewis could do short of serving a jail term other than pay up, President Truman refused to negotiate, and on December the 7th he called off the strike and Truman was jubilant. Truman said, "The White House is open to anybody with legitimate business, but not that son of a bitch." And, of course, most of the nation's newspapers united behind the president. Press barons on either side of the Atlantic have never been wild fans of trade unionists. And for a beleaguered and largely unpopular president, it turned out to be the first real piece of successful executive action that had occurred that year. Bringing two powerful trade unions to heel in the space of 6 months was quite an achievement for Truman, and the government could have been forgiven for thinking that the problems that they, as they perceived it, the problems that the unions created for the economy were over. But collective pay bargaining continued, and this had an impact. Not in the 40s and 50s, but would later in the 60s and 70s, it would have an impact on wages and prices in America as America and the rest of the world encountered waves of inflation and union militancy tend to go rather hand in hand. The problem that the unions faced as well wasn't so much from Truman as it was going to be from the changes to the American economy that would happen throughout the post-war era, away from heavy manufacturing around which trade unionism was based and a largely white male workforce, towards an entirely more fractured and fragmented economy where there was more individual working, loan working, there was more transition from blue collar to sort of white collar clerical work, harder to unionise, less accustomed to the culture of unionisation. There would be an influx of women into the workforce, black and ethnic minority men and women would eventually join the blue and white collar workforces across America on increasingly assertive terms, and these presented all sorts of sectional and economic challenges and organisational challenges to the trade unions that had really been previously white men's fraternities. Truman was not alone on Capitol Hill in being hostile to the trade union movement. And in 1947, a further offensive on the rights of trade unions began as congressmen who had, between the 1930s and the post-war years, been agitating for and campaigning for anti-union legislation to put what they saw as arrogant organised labour back in its place, began to organise to do just that. Previously, when Democratic Congresses had chosen to attack union rights, they had encountered the veto of Franklin Roosevelt, which was enforceable during the time of war. And both houses were seized by the Republicans in 1946 and strongly supported by Southern Democrats, conservative Southern Democrats. There was an electoral coalition there ready to deal a mighty blow to the trade union movement. This coalition was helped by employers, groups and lobbyists, and it was led by Fred Hartley in the House, who was a Republican and profoundly anti-union and from New Jersey. In the Senate, Robert Taft of Ohio, who was the son of the former President Taft, quickly drafted the Taft-Hartley bill in early 1947, and this was a bold and aggressive attempt to undo the Wagner Act of 1935. The Wagner Act, or the National Labour Relations Act, as it was also known, helped to address relations between unions and employers, but on decidedly more favourable terms for the trade unions. It prevented the kind of unethical and authoritarian business practices that were frequently employed in gerrymandering union elections in the workplace, bullying union stewards out of their jobs, and generally intimidating and undermining trade unions that operated in workplaces. All these sorts of things became...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Legal. But Taft-Hartley was a way of restoring the power of employers. The president could now call for an 80-day cooling-off period before strikes, and this, particularly those that would affect the national interest, but that is a very nebulous term, can be extended to fit pretty much anything. And it banned closed shops. It made sure that anybody who went to apply for a job didn't necessarily have to join the union as well. The bill prevented secondary boycotts. This is one of the great strengths of the labour movement, the ability for different trades and unions to show solidarity and strike as well. And it also spawned a generation of legislation, the right to work laws, which meant that individual states could pass legislation which undermined and created obstacles to union organising. And the way in which it was couched was that the union organising actually presented an obstacle to employment, and that people had the right to work without being expected to join the trade union. First of all, this would give employers, non-unionised employees, a lot easier to deal with and a lot easier to pay badly if you so chose. But also, it represented fears that the unions were in some way dominated by Reds, dominated by communists or communist fellow travellers, and that the Taft-Hartley Act was therefore in some ways an act of national security. Of course, the unions weren't dominated by communists. The unions were dominated by men, and in some cases women, but primarily men, who, for the most part, thought capitalism was terrific and wanted to participate in it even more, i.e. to access higher wages and better conditions so that their share of post-war prosperity would go up. The great majority of union members had little sympathy or interest in the Soviet Union and perhaps paid scant little attention to Cold War politics anyway, and they were the kind of conservative with a small c blue-collar working class of America, many of whom had experienced and endured the war, either on the battlefield or on the industrial front, and had a great deal of pride in their status as the kind of labour aristocracy, the American blue-collar working class. So the accusation that there was some sort of lingering Bolshevism at the heart of the American trade union movement is actually quite laughable. These institutions were far more conservative with a small c than they have been given credit for in the past. Taft-Hartley also required union members and union activists to sign non-communist affidavits if they wanted workers to get accesses to the National Labour Relations Board. And the NLRB had been the tool that the Wagner Act had created to police troublesome employers who were likely to whittle away workers' rights. The Taft-Hartley Act, therefore, which discriminated against communists and the and not just communists, but those perhaps suspected of communist involvement, meant that workers who did fall into this niche category could not be adequately represented or defended against their employers. It's hardly surprising, then, that the Taft-Hartley Act was referred to as the Slave Labour Act by trade unionists. And the CIO counsel, Lee Pressman, said, "When you think of it merely as a combination of individual provisions, you are losing entirely the full impact of the programme. The sinister conspiracy that has been hatched." Ironically, the Taft-Hartley Act didn't have the entire backing of Truman. Truman realised in 1946 that he'd rather overplayed his hands with the trade unions and lost serious support amongst blue-collar working-class communities in key marginal seats across America, and thought it time now to dial down the conflict and try to make a few friends. Truman vetoed the bill when it passed, realising now that union relations with the presidency were in freefall, but both houses actually overrode the veto. Truman didn't have the kinds of wartime executive powers that Roosevelt had, and also Truman, when he'd been a wartime president, had been able to wield, and he simply didn't have the executive authority to veto a piece of legislation like that. Union leaders then gave thought to going on strike in order to protest. And perhaps a decade earlier, they certainly would have done and would have succeeded. But now many union leaders in the AFL and the CIO realised that the world had turned quite considerably and they were existing in an entirely different political climate. Many members were unsure about how to proceed and what to do, and instead union leaders decided that they would fight the law in Congress and appealed to Congress to amend the Act. In reality, the Taft-Hartley Act, its power came more from its symbolism than from its actual legislative provisions. The end of closed shops certainly caused the unions to have a decrease of power in workplaces, and the anti-communist provisions were more easily accepted by trade unionists than has been previously suggested. They were able to swallow their civil liberties objections and sign. But bargaining with employers still continued, and in reality what the Taft-Hartley Act showed was more important than what it did. It showed that, as the unions had accepted it, that their power was in decline. And it also showed to a public who were perhaps wary of unions and of anything affiliated with the democratic left, or in their eyes, the undemocratic left, it showed that as Congress was willing to take action against the trade unions, that there must, by extension, be something to be suspicious of. At the time of the Taft-Hartley Act, another front in the struggle for union rights was unfolding in the South. The AFL and the CIO were in competition against one another to break the hold of anti-union employers in the South. This was loosely referred to as Operation Dixie. The Operation Dixie ran into difficulties from the get-go. State governments and the biggest employer of factory labour in the South, the textile industry, were determined to prevent the AFL and the CIO from succeeding. Agricultural employers who employed cotton and fruit pickers were also determined to stop any sort of inroads by the unions into the South. Anti-union leaders and organisers spoke openly to racist sentiment by suggesting that the CIO was attempting desegregation by hoping to represent both black and white workers. And in Birmingham, Alabama, a steel city, white steel workers were opposed to and rejected entreaties from the communist-dominated mine, mill and smelters work union that had a large number of black members. And interracial union organisation in the South failed and was part of the death knell of Operation Dixie. And by 1948, union figures in the South, union membership in the South, was actually lower than it had been in 1945, as trade unions were associated with all sorts of unpleasant anti-Southern notions, such as civil rights and racial integration. So there you go, we'll leave it there. I hope you found that useful, and we'll return to Truman's America in the not too distant future. If you found this interesting and you want to say hi, check us out on the Explaining History Facebook page. It'd be great to speak to you there, and we'll catch you on the next podcast soon. All the best, bye bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.